Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order they will be presented, they are the Commissioner of Human Services versus Low-Income Women of Texas and others in Travis County, Bob Carpenter and others versus Cimarron Hydrocarbons Corporation from Jack County, and Travis County versus Pelzel and Associates, also from Travis County. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral arguments in this call, in their causes. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will conclude all three arguments before lunch. If you wish to purchase a tape of any argument, you may make application with our clerk, and those will be made available to you for a nominal fee. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioners in Bose versus Low-Income Women of Texas.
May I please the court? Mr. Jeffrey Boyd present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court? The Texas Equal Rights Amendment prohibits the legislature from purposefully discriminating against Texas citizens because of their gender, but it does not prohibit laws that merely affect one gender and not the other. The plaintiffs in this case demonstrated on summary judgment evidence that Section 32.024 of the Texas Human Resource Code has an effect upon women that it does not have on men, a disparate impact, if you will. But they offered no evidence, there is none in the record, because in fact there is none anywhere, that that provision of the Texas statute was adopted by the legislature with the purpose of treating women differently because they are women. This court should reverse the Court of Appeals decision in this case.
Are you saying that the Equal Rights Amendment prohibits the legislature from passing a law that it intends to discriminate against women, but doesn't prohibit the legislature from passing a law that in fact discriminates against women?
It's actually slightly different than that because of the technical legal definition of intend. Intend, as the court is aware, under court law, with the knowledge of substantial certainty that a particular result will occur as a result of your conduct, you may have an intent attributed to you. But what the ERA does is it prohibits the legislature from purposefully treating a person differently because of their membership in that class. The law may, in fact, have a different effect on members of that class, but it doesn't violate the ERA simply because of a different effect. We know that for at least three reasons. One is the language of the ERA itself. The ERA says that rights equality shall not be abridged or denied because of gender, sex, race, color, or national origin. The words because of must have some meaning. If there wasn't a motivational element to the words because of in the ERA, there would be no need for those words there.
Is the constitutional analysis the same under the Equal Protection Clause as under the ERA?
The analysis is the same. The only difference is whether gender rises to the level of a suspect classification, and this court has made that clear in the McLean case.
But otherwise, the analysis is exactly the same?
The analysis is exactly the same under the ERA, and in fact, in the Richards versus Lulac case in 1992, that's exactly what this court said. In Richards v. Lulac, this court, because what happened in that case was the allegation was that there was discrimination based on race and national origin. And this court in that case specifically said there's no difference between the analysis under the ERA or the equal protection provision of the Texas Constitution because both of them provide that race and national origin are suspect classifications. Gender, on the other hand, at least through Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court precedent, does not rise to the level of a suspect class entitled to strict scrutiny. The ERA raises it to that level.
But if the ERA did apply to this case, would you lose?
If the ERA applied to this case, well, the ERA, to understand your question.
Well, apply, of course it applies, but if it applied in a way that it was impacted by the ERA, then in other words, this was a sex classification, would you lose?
If disparate impact were sufficient to show a violation of the ERA, the state would lose in this case. Because there is a disparate impact on women than there is on men. It's not only women who are impacted by this legislation, but there is a different impact. But the state would suggest to the court that we could take statistical analyses of how many men versus women get speeding tickets and find a disparate impact. Disparate impact in and of itself is insufficient to show a violation. Number one, because of the because of language of ERA, and in fact, it's this court's own decision in the case of Quantum Corporation, I think was the name of the case, which actually was a statutory construction case involving the state statute implementing Title VII. And there, the question was whether the test for determining whether there was a violation of that statute required showing a motivating factor or that it was the only motivating factor that this particular plaintiff was fell within that class. And what the court said in that case is that because of, and the direct quote was, the words because of in the statute are inherently ambiguous. But what the court explained was they're ambiguous because they're ambiguous as to whether it must be a motivating factor or the only motivating factor. But it still has to be a motivating factor. If it didn't, all the ERA would have to say is that no equality shall not be denied or abridged to anyone of a particular gender or to anyone of a particular race or to anyone of a particular national origin. But by choosing the words because of, the language itself indicates that there must be a motivational factor, a purpose to discriminate because of the person's membership of that
but
class.
But is that, well, isn't that issue taken care of by the review that's applied? You apply strict scrutiny. Strict scrutiny isn't applied to the notion of, well, was this a motivating factor? It's applied to the motivation of the government for what the government claims to be its reason for doing so, acknowledging that it has a disparate impact, and the court concludes that the government's reason for doing so doesn't survive strict scrutiny, therefore the statute's unconstitutional. So, I mean, isn't the court required to focus on the other reasons given for the statute, and if those are sufficient, then that takes care of it. If they're not sufficient, it doesn't. And aren't you asking us to do it kind of backwards by, well, if it's only some motivating factor, it doesn't count, or if it's no motivating factor?
No, Your Honor.
We're doing backwards.
No, Your Honor, because that question confuses the purposeful discrimination in the statute from the purpose that the legislature seeks to achieve by the statute. The example would be the Tungate or Barber cases, the hair regulation cases. A hair regulation in a school says males may not have hair longer than their collar. Females may. On its face, that regulation purposefully discriminates against that person because of their gender. On its face, there's no other reason for the distinction. All laws, at least any law that's even susceptible to a good faith ERA challenge, discriminates. It's inherent in the nature of law to treat different people differently. The question is, does this law discriminate for the purpose, does it purposefully discriminate because of that person's membership in the class? Once you show that, if you show that in fact there is purposeful discrimination in the law, then you get to the strict scrutiny analysis, which then brings in the question of what is the purpose that's sought to be achieved by the law.
What would be an example of purposeful discrimination?
Example of purposeful discrimination come, number one, out of the Mercer, Barber, and Tungate cases, where on its face they are intentionally, the purpose discrimination in those regulations is to treat someone differently because they are male. It's on its face. Another example is the McLean case, where the parental preference doctrine was applied to mothers but not to fathers. Because they are female, they have a greater benefit or right to the parental rights than the males do. And this court struck that down because on its face it was purposeful discrimination.
On the road to striking that down, though, didn't the court say in McLean that the whether or not the state has a lofty goal is not really determinative of whether the statute violates the Equal Rights Amendment in some way? And what the respondent is arguing, as I understand it, is they look at the analysis of McLean and say, if it in fact treats the plaintiff differently on the basis of their gender, then that is a potential violation of the statute. How do you address that?
And the, again, respondents are confusing the purposed discrimination, the aim of the discrimination, what class you're drawing the line between, versus the purpose to be achieved by the statute. It doesn't matter how great the purpose to be achieved by the statute is, if it discriminates on the basis because of, to use the words of the ERA, gender. So, for example, another example, you begin then with that fundamental principle that there must be a purpose to discriminate.
But Mr. Boyd, the examples that you give seem to me to be the very examples that your opponents are relying upon to say that this does violate the ERA, because all medically necessary procedures for men are covered by the statute, but not all medically necessary procedures for women are covered. So if I recall their briefing correctly, it seems to me they're relying on those very examples to say that there is a violation. So what is your response to that argument?
My response to that is that they misconstrue by changing the levels of analysis. For example, comparing the purposed discrimination versus the purpose to be achieved. They start with men versus women. And yet, in reality, you go under women, and there are women who are indigent, women who are not indigent, or you can actually start with indigency. Start with indigency. Men versus women, are we drawing a line between them on the face of this statute, or even on the face of the Hyde Amendment? No, because women are entitled to benefits for medically necessary care. Well, are all women entitled to that? No, there are pregnant women and not pregnant women. All non-pregnant women are entitled to that. And then you break down under the pregnant women, there are those who choose to give birth to the child and those who choose to have an abortion. And that's when you get to the point where there is a discrimination, so to speak.
But under that analysis, there would never be a gender or race discrimination. I mean, if you're talking about not serving a certain race of people at a lunch counter, that's not everybody. That's just ones who choose to go to a lunch counter. Or it's only people who men who choose to have children and not support them in McLean. I mean, there's seldom any law that affects 120 million people.
But Chief Justice Phillips, that's the whole point. And I would direct you to the Feeney case from 1979 in the U.S. Supreme Court. And in particular, and most interesting, the Bailey versus City of Austin case, which came out of the Third Court, actually written by the very justice who wrote the opinion in this case, who recognized that the analysis is, first we look to see, does it discriminate on the basis or because of their classification on its face? The haircut law, the hair length regulations do, the paternal preference law did in McLean. But there are cases in which they don't, and Feeney is a perfect example of that. In Feeney, on its face, it gave hiring preferences to veterans. It didn't say, we're only going to give hiring preferences to men. It said on its face, we're only going to give hiring preferences to veterans. The allegation was, hey, the impact of that is that you are 98.3% of everyone that gets those benefits are men. And so you are violating the rights of the women who are not getting those benefits. And the analysis that the Supreme Court took on that case was to look, okay, it's not facially discriminatory. It is facially neutral. And so now we have to look and see, is there a discriminatory purpose? Is the legislature's real purpose here to discriminate on the basis of the fact that those people who aren't getting the benefit are women? Is that their real purpose? And the Feeney Court indicated three things to look at in making that analysis. First thing you look at is the actual language of the statute. Is it facially discriminatory on that suspect class or not? In this case, it's not. 32.024 discriminates, if at all, on the basis of whether the procedure you are seeking receives federal matching funds.
Let me ask you about let's change up the circumstance. Now, we're dealing with sickle cell anemia. That's a condition that applies mostly to African-American descent. Let's suppose the statute permits treatment for medically necessary illnesses, but the statute says we will not treat a particular condition by treating sickle cell anemia. Now, that doesn't discriminate based on race under your theory, because it's not a distinction between African Americans and other races, because it's a subcategory, only a small subcategory in the African American ethnic population. Would that survive a strict scrutiny analysis under these facts? The state just says we'll only do what the feds do, and so there will be no public funding for a treatment that goes to sickle cell anemia. We'll treat all the complications of it, but we won't treat that. Would that survive strict scrutiny?
Your Honor, you don't get to the strict scrutiny analysis until you first determine whether there is purposeful discrimination on the basis of race. And the way you do it under Feeney and even under the Bailey decision by Justice Smith in this third court, the way you do that is you look first to say, is it facially neutral as applied to this classification? And the answer in that hypothetical is yes. It doesn't discriminate on the basis of race on the face of the legislation. Then you look to two other things. What is the purpose for this discrimination?
Why doesn't Justice Enoch's example discriminate on the face of the statute? If it says we'll treat all medically necessary conditions except sickle cell anemia, and sickle cell anemia only affects African Americans.
Because what you are doing
there... Why isn't that facially unconstitutional?
Because on the face of the statute, Justice Hankinson, you are denying benefits... not to blacks or Hispanics or whatever race it may be directed at, but you are denying benefits because this person needs treatment for sickle cell anemia. That's on the face of the statute. Now, you may look at that. It's kind of like the hypothetical legislation of saying we're going to outlaw yarmulkes. You know, you look on the face of it, that's facially neutral. It doesn't discriminate against people of Jewish faith. But then you look at, okay, what is the purpose for doing that? What is the legislature's, the purpose they're seeking to achieve by making that distinction? And you compare that to, and you balance that with the impact on the people, on the members of that particular protected
class. And how do you determine that purpose?
You determine that purpose by looking at the manner in which that particular regulation is acted out within the legislative scheme. So, for example, it's clear in this case under 32024, the purpose was to have a conservative fiscal approach to the implementation of the Medicaid program. I see my time is up. May I?
You can answer.
Okay.
So you
look first to see how it works itself out within the scheme. What is the stated purpose, and does it in fact achieve that purpose? And so, for example, you can look here to see that in fact. Under 32.024, limiting the expenditures to those situations for which there is federal matching funds provides a fiscal conservative approach to the state implementation of the Medicaid program. If, as the respondents would say, you should imply or impute to the state of Texas the policies behind the Hyde Amendment, then you look to the purpose of the Hyde Amendment. The purpose of the Hyde Amendment is to promote childbirth over abortion and thereby protect potential life.
Can we properly impute the federal motives to the state in adopting this, or as it were, delegating this decision of what to cover and what not?
When the challenge is, as it is here, Your Honor, to the Texas Medicaid program, 32.024 of the Texas Human Resources Code, you have to look at what is the purpose of that particular provision within the Medicaid program. That provision was adopted in 1967 when the state of Texas first opted into the Medicaid program.
Well, let me be simple. What if the Medicaid program says no American Indians will be covered? And our law just says we do what Medicaid does.
And then in that situation, the American Indians who would challenge that law would have to challenge the federal law that is passed through the state law
so
to affect their benefits.
The state courts couldn't really do anything about it other than strike down a law of Congress. And it would be only a federal question.
That's right. The state court could strike down that law on federal constitutional grounds.
So you're saying really the only challenge they have here is a challenge to the McRae case. It's already been decided.
That's correct.
And they can take that up through state court and see if the Supreme Court wants to look at it again.
Well, and that's why we were entitled to summary judgment in this case, because the Supreme Court has looked at it and made that decision already.
Well, let me ask you, I thought you said earlier in your argument, maybe I misunderstood, that sex is not a suspect class. Did you say that earlier? In the federal scheme, it's not.
It is a class entitled to intermediate scrutiny as opposed to rational basis.
But you say under the ERA amendment, if it has any effect at all, the Equal Rights Amendment in the Texas Constitution, if it has any effect at all, is to raise from being the intermediate class to a suspect class. So let me go back to my question. If we disagree with you that the government can pass a law that affects only a subsegment of a particular race, and we conclude that that is discriminatory, and we evaluate it based on a suspect class, strict scrutiny, would Texas's refusal to pay this survive that inquiry?
It would not. If the court were to determine that, I don't want to rephrase your question completely, but I want to make sure I understand your question. If the court were to determine that impact by itself is sufficient to demonstrate the denial of equality because of gender or race, to use Your Honor's hypothetical, if the court were to determine that, then the plaintiffs will have gotten by step one, which is to show that this in fact does deny equality because of gender. Then you apply strict scrutiny, which is different than what the federal courts would apply, and require the state to show a compelling interest and a narrowly tailored, that the statute's narrowly tailored to meet that interest. And I think the state would concede that if the court went that direction, that this law would not survive strict scrutiny.
The state does concede that we have to analyze this law based on ordinary Texas equal protection.
Yes. I mean, the challenge is under the Texas Constitution, and so, yes, you'll have to apply that.
Yes, and you've already said that the stated purpose was following the federal guidelines so as to maximize the bang for the buck.
That is the purpose of the Medicaid provisions of 32024.
Is there any other state purpose that's present that we would, whatever we decided the classification for rational scrutiny review was, whether it's pregnant versus non-pregnant women, or whether it's an income classification, or whatever the classification, if there is a classification, is there any other state purpose beyond maximizing the Texas taxpayers' benefit for amount spent?
The state has, in other contexts, demonstrated a policy purpose of promoting childbirth over abortion, for example, in the State Appropriations Act. So the state legislature certainly has demonstrated that as a policy objective within the state of Texas. Our point is that the provisions challenged here, 32.024 of the Texas Medicaid Act, which were adopted 6 years before Roe v. Wade and 10 years before the Hyde Amendment was ever even adopted, clearly that provision was not adopted for the purpose of achieving that particular purpose of promoting childbirth over abortion. That's not to say that that is not a policy purpose of the state of Texas, but it is not a policy purpose that underlies the enactment of 32.024.
Would you agree that yours is a minority position among the states that have decided this issue?
6-5 minority. If you look at the Supreme Court decisions of the states that have decided this issue under their own constitution, it's 6-5.
And do you distinguish the ones that have gone against you based upon the wording of the statute? Do their statutes have this fiscal sort of element to it?
No, I distinguish. I would distinguish those decisions that have gone the other way, for example, California, New Mexico, and others. Now, one of them, New Mexico, did it based on their equal rights amendments, the only one that did it based on equal rights amendment. The others did it based on due process or general privacy rights under their constitution.
But were their statutes worded the same way as this one is, which seems to sort of wholesale adopt the federal restriction on matching funds?
To be honest, Your Honor, I don't recall, but I don't believe so. I think we have a different situation here than they had in New Mexico or California, for example, in that we have here a statute that's being challenged, which on its face simply limits the expenditures to those for which there are federal matching
funds.
And
you don't know if those states have a similar sort of
I don't recall. I could certainly provide additional briefing on that if the court would like. I don't recall.
You said there are three parts of that Feeney analysis, whether the statute is facially neutral, the purpose for the discrimination, and what was.
And the impact on this on the protected class. So, for example, here you would look to see that there is, in fact, a disparate impact on this class. So, under the veterans preference case of the Feeney case, the court looked to say, in fact, it used the word severe impact. 98.3% of all the people that got the benefit were men. And the court said that is a severe impact on women. However, they balanced that impact versus what was the real purpose. Purpose discrimination, which was not to distinguish between men and women, but to distinguish between veterans and non-veterans, which in fact, as acted out within the implementation of that statute, justified the ultimate goal of the statute, which was to take care of and benefit veterans and honor them for their service in the military. Here you would see the same thing work out under either the Hyde Amendment analysis or 32.024.
Dissenting justice in the Court of Appeals offered a theory that the Constitution, 51.028, some section like that, the Constitution itself forbade the state from making this choice. And nobody seems to have adopted that in a brief. Was that just a concession to brevity of life, or do you think that argument does not hold up?
I'm not exactly sure, Your Honor, which argument. The Constitution in Article 3, 8, Section 6, and Article 344,
well,
and we
this
have
is Article
3, that.
Section 51.51A. Article 3, Section 51A, I believe, which was of the Constitution, was specifically amended in order to allow the states to spend money in a way that would entitle them to the federal sharing.
I think you've got me at a loss, Your Honor. I do recall that language, but I don't recall why we didn't brief it.
During a spare moment while you're sitting down, would you like the second half of Judge Engel's dissent? I'd
be happy to.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Bonnie Jones present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Almost 30 years ago, the people of Texas overwhelmingly passed an equal rights amendment to their state constitution to stop unequal treatment of women by the state. This case asks whether the promise of that ERA is going to hold true for poor women who are pregnant and ill.
Would you agree that the state statute in this case is facially neutral because it's premised upon matching federal funds?
No, the program at issue here
facially
is not facially neutral. The Texas Medicaid program, through its statutes, its regulations, and its policy manuals, which are binding on participants, limit the state's funds to abortions that are needed to save a woman's life or for rape or incest. They do not provide funds for medically necessary abortions, although they provide funds for any other medically necessary care.
But the statute we're talking about here simply says that the state Medicaid funds will be paid to the extent they're matched by federal funds. And that particular statute, in and of itself, without looking at the booklets or regulations, appears to be facially neutral.
The statute, well, there's two things, Your Honor. One is that we challenged the funding ban as a whole, not just in the statute. The statute, the regulation, the state's implementation of a Medicaid program that denies medically necessary abortions to poor women. The statute itself, in addition, adopts the terms of the Hyde Amendment. It adopts all funding limitations of the federal government. By adopting those terms, it cannot be said to be facially neutral. You'd have to look at what those terms are to see whether it's facially neutral or not.
Well, does that implicate the state's argument that your argument's based on our court interpreting the Hyde Amendment under our equal rights amendment?
This court,
not the statute itself, but the Hyde Amendment that's sitting out there as the
What this court needs to interpret is the state's implementation of a program of comprehensive health care that denies one service, and it's a service that is only needed by pregnant women. That is what the court has to analyze today against the requirements of the Equal Rights Amendment.
Was the statute in Feeney facially neutral?
the statute in Feeney was facially neutral because it had. This is not a disparate impact case. Feeney was. A disparate impact case involves a statute that is facially neutral and that has places a disadvantage on both men and women, albeit to different degrees, but it places a burden on both sexes. Here, there is no burden placed on both sexes. It only applies to pregnant women. So it's just like in McLean, where the statute only applied a higher standard of eligibility to fathers because that only applied to men. It was a sex classification.
McLean was a situation where it was possible to treat men and women equally, and the legislature had chosen not to. And here, if you're dealing with abortion, it's not to treat men and women equally.
Well, it certainly is possible to treat men and women equally under the Medicaid program. The purpose of the Medicaid program is to provide medically necessary care to the eligible poor. And the way to treat men and women equally is if you're going to generally provide all medically necessary services to the poor, you provide them to men and you provide them to women, whether they're pregnant or not. So the state could provide all medically necessary services to both sexes. The purpose.
May I ask you something?
Pardon me?
Would you identify who and what is low-income women of Texas? Is that an association, a corporation, or a generic term, or what?
No, Your Honor, it's a class of women who are eligible.
But does it exist in reality other than?
No, it's just a name for the class of women who are affected.
So we have four doctors and a clinic that are representing those interests in this case, is that correct?
They represent the interests of their patients, and a class was certified representing the interests of the women of Texas who are eligible for Medicaid, who will need abortions during the pendency of this lawsuit because of health conditions.
So it's a class action?
Yes.
Certified. And the next thing, I couldn't find it and may have missed it. What exactly is the injunctive relief at the Court of Appeals judgment gave the respondent?
I believe that she gave the court gave the injunctive relief we asked for.
I understand, but what is it? Exactly what does it say?
It's to prohibit the state from enforcing the statutes and regulations that preclude it from paying for medically necessary abortions on the same terms as it pays for all other medically necessary care for Medicaid recipients.
Is this ordering then the state to pay for medically necessary abortions or ordering the state not to pay for any medically necessary procedures of any sort to anybody?
It's ordering the state not to exclude medically necessary abortions from the program that already generally provides for medically necessary care and that already has funds appropriated
Shouldn't
for that.
Shouldn't that
care?
Be the legislature's choice whether to expand this program or shut the program down altogether?
Well, it's the legislature's choice whether to adopt a Medicaid program, but once it does so, it is required by the Texas Constitution to respect the rights of Texans. And it is this court's job to determine whether the program that the legislature created measures up to the standards imposed by the Texas Equal Rights Amendment.
The state could have chosen simply not to participate in the Medicaid program.
Certainly, and it could have chosen to exclude broad categories of care if it wanted to.
So if we rule in your favor, shouldn't we allow the state to make that choice?
Well, if the state does not wants to cancel its Medicaid program in order to stop paying for medically necessary abortions, it can certainly do that in response to this court's ruling. But the state has promulgated the program for two goals that would still be met if the relief we're asking for is given. Those goals are to provide health care to the poor and to obtain all available matching funds for that care. If this court orders the state to pay for medically necessary abortions, both of those goals will still be met.
How can we order the state to spend money? Isn't that a legislative prerogative to appropriate and designate how funds are spent and not this court or the judicial branch's function?
The state has already appropriated money for the Medicaid program to pay for medically necessary care. All this court would be doing is striking down an unconstitutional restriction on those funds, and that is the province of this court, as the Alaska Supreme Court said recently in addressing.
But does that have the effect of implicitly ordering the state to pay for those medically necessary procedures?
It has the effect that the funds will go to procedures that the legislature might not have envisioned, just as has happened in many cases in which unconstitutional laws are stricken. When the Supreme Court struck down the segregation of schools, desegregated schools, the funds that were given to schools ended up paying for desegregated schools, even though that's not what the legislature envisioned. When the Supreme Court Shapiro versus Thompson struck down an eligibility requirement on welfare benefits, those welfare benefits ended up going to newcomers, even though the legislature didn't foresee that that would happen. It is the province of the court to measure legislative actions against the Constitution, and if necessary, to strike down restrictions. And that does not require any new appropriation or an appropriation by this court.
Well, but there's only so many dollars.
Yes, but there is already adequate money in there.
And those dollars equal what the federal government sends to Texas. Is that correct?
That's not exactly correct. What happens is the state allocates money for the Medicaid program. The state spends the money. So long as it's spending money on things for which it can receive matching funds, it submits a bill of sorts to the federal government and gets the matching funds. All it would have to do here is, to the extent it pays money that is not for services that can be matched, it just needs to keep a separate accounting of those and not seek matching funds.
What's the level of the match, essentially? I mean, what percentage of all of the Medicaid payments comes from the federal instead of the state?
I'm not sure of exactly. The state may be able to tell you. I think it's something slightly above half. Might be about 60%.
Mr. Jones, will you turn your attention to responding to Mr. Boyd's argument that the Texas ERA requires a showing of purposeful discrimination? There has been none here.
Yes, Your Honor. That contention has already been flatly refuted by the court in McLean, which held that when a law imposes a disadvantage only on one sex, that's a sex classification that it's not necessarily unconstitutional, but it must meet strict scrutiny. And the same thing has happened here. They have placed a burden only on women, even only on pregnant women, and that must meet strict scrutiny. The court in McLean held that even lofty goals wouldn't permit sex classifications to just escape without the scrutiny of this court. So intent is not necessary under the Texas ERA when the law places a burden only on one sex.
Can you explain you're responding to Mr. Boyd's argument under Feeney, and could you elaborate on that a little bit? He apparently concedes that if the court gets to a strict scrutiny analysis, then the state loses. But he says we don't get there. And he says Feeney is the reason why. Now, can you
certainly
distinguish that? Or
Feeney is not the reason why for a number of reasons. First of all, it was decided under the less protective federal constitution, which does not contain an ERA.
Of course, his point is that only comes after you determine there's purposeful discrimination. Feeney says there's not a purposeful discrimination.
The Texas ERA does more than just apply a heightened level of scrutiny. It does not follow the federal analysis. It provides independent, strong protection against sex discrimination in this state. And the court has held in McLean that when you place a burden on only one sex, that is subject to strict scrutiny. You don't have to look at intent. So in that way, McLean offers a different analysis than Feeney does. Furthermore, they're just not the same type of case. Feeney is a disparate impact case in which both men and women were burdened, but to different degrees. This court has not yet decided whether it's going to require a showing of intent in disparate impact cases. It says so in LULAC.
We're obviously talking only about women for obvious reasons. So that's the big class. But then there was discussion about reducing that class to smaller subclasses, and we get to pregnant and non-pregnant women, and then we get to women who choose to either carry the child or not, and then we're to the issue of should medically necessary abortion procedures be included in what's paid. Is that correct? So that the class we're looking at is not men versus women. We're looking at a subclass of, in your view, as I would understand it, disparate treatment between women only.
Your Honor, as Chief Justice Phillips pointed out, if you reduce the class in discrimination suit to that small a level, you will never find discrimination. In McLean, you could have said, this isn't about men. This isn't discrimination against men. This is only discrimination against men who have children out of wedlock, and decide that they want to come establish paternity through a legal proceeding. The fact is, the court has recognized that the ERA protects more strongly than that. If a law burdens only one sex, as it did there, only disadvantaging men, that's sex discrimination. The same is true here. It may just affect women who are pregnant and need abortions because they're suffering from cancer or diabetes, but the fact is, only women are ever denied medically necessary care.
Let me ask you this. Why shouldn't we look at the U.S. Supreme Court decisions that look specifically at the Hyde Amendments and determine in McRae or in Bray that the restrictions on funding in the Hyde Amendment are not class are not sex-based classifications? Why shouldn't we take that as the ground for our decision here? And if it's not classification based on sex, doesn't that end the inquiry for us?
There are a couple of reasons why not. The first is, again, that the Texas Constitution undisputedly provides greater protection against sex discrimination than the federal Constitution. Second, in the Harris versus McRae and Maher cases, which considered funding bans similar to the like the one here, the Supreme Court did not address a sex discrimination claim. Sex discrimination was not raised in either case. The Bray case is a different issue. It addresses whether the actions of private actors expressing disfavor towards abortion show animosity towards women under a statute that required a showing of animosity towards women. It's simply an inapposite here because, as we've discussed, the ERA does not require a showing of any sort of malicious or invidious intent towards women for a finding of discrimination. So the fact that Bray found that disfavoring abortion doesn't discriminate against women doesn't tell us anything about whether excluding medically necessary abortions from a state-funded program of health care is sex discrimination.
Ms. Jones, the Court of Appeals Justice who wrote this opinion also wrote the opinion of Bailey versus City of Austin. And there she did make some differentiations in the Bailey versus City of Austin case, where she said the classification at issue there, this is a domestic partner benefits issue, she said the issue there was not homosexuals, but unmarried domestic partners. So how do we differentiate the two cases? And that was an equal rights case.
It was an equal rights case, but it was a disparate impact case again. It didn't affect just the class. It was a law that affected all unmarried persons. And the claim there was that it imposed a disparate impact on homosexuals rather than unmarried heterosexuals. But the fact was, it had placed a burden on both groups. And so the court had to evaluate whether there was such a disparate impact as to evidence a showing of discrimination. There's no need to make that kind of inquiry here because the burdens are only placed on women. It's not a disparate impact
case. In McLean, it would be very easy for the legislature to have treated both sexes equally.
In McLean?
Yes. Yeah. It would be easy to have the same burden of proof. Well, the legislature didn't do that. But in any regulation of abortion, it's impossible to treat men and women equally if you're looking at abortion. So under your analysis that this is sexual discrimination because it can only affect women, how could the legislature ever pass any laws on abortion? How could they do what Roe v. Wade says a legislature can do and prohibit abortions late term?
The state has a couple of different interests at stake. If you're talking about a law that regulates abortion that is passed in order to further the state's interest in potential life, then if the court was evaluating that sort of law, it would have to look at whether men and women are differently situated with respect to that interest, and it may well find, as you say, that women are differently situated than men when the state is trying to promote its interest in potential life. But that's not the interest here. The state hasn't claimed it is. It said it would be happy to pay for medically necessary abortions if the federal government did. The interest here is in providing health care to the poor and securing all available matching funds. Men and women are not differently situated with respect to that goal. A woman who is pregnant and needs an abortion so that she can get cancer treatments or reduce her hypertension is exactly the same situation with respect to Medicaid, to Texas Medicaid, as a man is who has prostate cancer or whatever other treatment. So you can only determine whether men and women are similarly situated with respect to the law by looking at the purpose of the law. And with, let's say, a parental notice requirement or something of that nature, the purpose of the law is going to be a very different one than it is here. Here it's providing help.
Not similarly situated if it's going to cost twice as much to provide this treatment as it would to provide any other treatment,
but it won't
because
cost
of a choice that the other co-funder
is. But it won't cost twice as much. The evidence is undisputed that it is far cheaper to provide women with these health conditions with medically necessary abortions than to cause them to carry a complicated pregnancy to term and go through childbirth. It is undisputed that the money already allocated just for the state's portion is enough. There is no cost saving here. There's not a shred of evidence that a cent would be saved by this. All the state is doing is sacrificing the health of pregnant women so that it doesn't have to pay money for something that it's not getting matching funds for. That's the only interest at stake.
On the issue of the medically necessary treatment, the under this, the way this law applies, could the legislature, even if it applied only to one sex, make a determination that all medically necessary treatment will be available, except there will be certain types of treatment that will not be used? And they've already declared that experimental treatments will not be paid for. That's what the feds say. But could they say that we understand there's a treatment out here when someone suffers from hypertension or cancer or these kinds of things, that they could opt for the abortion, not because it solves the health condition they have, but because it complicates the treatment for the health condition they have? Could the government just decide that's just not a decision that the patient, the doctor, are going to be able to make? If we're going to pay for it, we're going to say they're going to have to use some other treatment. Could the legislature, even if it applied only to one sex, make a determination that all medically necessary treatment will be available, except there will be certain types of treatment that will not be used? And they've already declared that experimental treatments will not be paid for. That's what the feds say. But could they say that we understand there's a treatment out here when someone suffers from hypertension or cancer or these kinds of things, that they could opt for the abortion, not because it solves the health condition they have, but because it complicates the treatment for the health condition they have? Could the government just decide that's just not a decision that the patient, the doctor, are going to be able to make? If we're going to pay for it, we're going to say they're going to have to use some other treatment for their condition, which is the hypertension or the cancer, that they'll have to use if they're going to expect public funds to do that. Doesn't that affect the analysis on a discrimination claim? The women here are not being denied medically necessary treatment. They're being denied just one aspect of the treatment that might be called for to avoid other complications as a part of the treatment process for what the injury is that they're suffering from. Assuming that the pregnancy is not life-threatening, it's not threatening their life, then could the government make some determinations as differentiating as between the sexes that this is the type of treatment, this won't be one of the alternatives that would be taxpayer supported?
The state can modify its definition of medical necessity, but it has to do so in a way that complies with the Texas Equal Rights Amendment. So if it's going to change its definition, it needs to do it in a way that either treats men and women equally or is justified by a compelling interest. And here it has not done so. It has applied one standard of medical necessity generally to the whole Medicaid program, except for a pregnant woman who needs an abortion to save her health. And in that instance, it's applied a higher standard and only subjected those women to that standard. Under McLean, that's a sex classification, and the state concedes it cannot meet strict scrutiny.
Is it permissible for a legislator, whether federal or state, to consider that there is no widespread popular objection to this list of 200 medical procedures? up to and including vasectomies or hernia operations or anything else, but there is widespread opposition among the public to this one particular medical procedure, and that everyone's taxes will be applied to pay for those procedures. And whether rightly or wrongly, half my constituency thinks this procedure is fundamentally morally wrong. Can that enter into a legislator's equation at all?
That's going to depend on the interest at stake and the purpose of the program. Here, the purpose of the program is not to provide care to the poor when it's generally considered acceptable to the populace. The program is to save the health of the poor by providing them care that they can't afford on their own. So in this context, that interest is just not related to the purpose.
Well, the purpose, you know, say there's a male who wants a sex change operation, to use the Chief Justice's hypothetical. Can he be denied that treatment even though it may cause him psychological problems and there may be medical necessity associated with his desire to change sexes? Does the legislature have to fund such an operation?
The legislature can exclude broad categories of care as long as it does so consistent with the Texas Equal Rights Amendment. If it prohibited all sex change operations and that prohibited them for men and for women and for generally people of different races, it may be able to do that. But it can't preclude care just needed by women, which is what it's done here.
But under your analysis, we always have to go behind the statute itself, because in fact when this statute was written, the Hyde Amendment wasn't even in place, right? So you're always requiring us to undertake an analysis of the impact of the statute, which is, seems to me contrary to what you were saying before, that we don't have to look at, that this is not a disparate impact case. But it seems to me that your argument forces us to do that. So with respect to every piece of legislation, we'll have to look behind it and see not whether it is neutral on its face or whether it has some purpose to discriminate, but in the end, or if it has a very noble purpose of saving the fisc, but instead, what sort of impact does it have generally?
That's not exactly what I'm arguing, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that you have to look at the program on its face. This program on its face does exclude medically necessary abortions and nothing else. If you just
not when it was first written, right?
No, not when it was first written, but now it does. I mean, because intent is not a relevant question here, you don't have to look back at what it did in 1967. What you need to look at is what does this program do now? And what this program does now on its face is provide all medically necessary care except one treatment needed by pregnant women. So that's the extent of what the court has to look at to determine that there's a sex classification that has to meet strict scrutiny.
Is it a classification based on sex or a classification based on the unborn child?
It's a classification that only affects pregnant women, and under McLean.
But is it based on the unborn child or the fact that it's a woman?
The program that Texas has enacted it only places a burden on women. And the purpose of it is not to protect potential life. That is not an interest of the state. So whatever the motivating factor is, it's not potential life, and the result is to cause women to face health risks that men don't have to face. The state has never said that its program is designed to promote potential life.
But you said the regulations carry forward the Hyde Amendment and that you're challenging the regulations themselves.
We're challenging the Medicaid program, which does adopt the terms of the Hyde Amendment, but the state has explicitly said that it does not adopt the purpose of the Hyde Amendment. It says that its purpose is to provide health care to the poor and assure access to all matching funds. It can do both those things regardless of whether it pays for medically necessary abortions. And to quickly answer the Chief Justice's question regarding the constitutional provision discussed in the dissent, that provision only limits the legislative action to the extent that it would make the Medicaid program ineligible for federal matching funds. And the Supreme Court has explicitly stated in Harris versus McRae that providing funds for medically necessary abortions by the state does not affect the state's eligibility for any other funds. So there is no constitutional limitation.
If we decided that this was not a classification based on sex, then that ends the question, right? You lose under, if that's what we decide.
No, we still not lose. Because even if it's not a classification subject to strict scrutiny, under this court's rational basis analysis under the Texas Constitution, this would still have to fail. Even under the rational basis test, this court requires a connection between the classification that's being challenged and the ultimate purpose of the law at issue. The court clearly dictated that in the recent case of H.L. Farm, which is cited in our briefs. There, the courts, there was no suspect class challenge, no fundamental right challenge, and the court said, what we have to do here is look at this classification and determine if it's rational. And to do that, we've got to determine what the purpose of this program is and figure out whether it makes sense. Well, if you look at the purpose of Texas Medicaid, of providing health care to the poor and of ensuring access to all matching funds, you will see that this exclusion is not even rationally related to the interest. In fact, it directly undercuts the interest of providing needed medical care to the poor.
But as I understand the state's argument, its rational basis is receipt of federal matching funds. So you've lost me there. Why isn't there a connection?
The statute's purpose is to make sure that all available matching funds are given to Medicaid recipients in Texas. That goal is unaffected by whether or not the state pays for medically necessary abortions for its Medicaid recipients.
Can the goal be not to pay for more than is matched by federal funds?
Well, that's what the state is saying its interest is now, but that's not the stated purpose of the Medicaid program. And this court said in H.L. Farm, you have to look at the purpose of the law. The purpose of the law was not to make sure that the state didn't pay 1 cent for something that the federal government wasn't going to pay for. That wasn't its purpose. Its purpose was to provide a comprehensive health program for the poor and to gain access to federal funds to do so. So there's not even a rational relationship to those two goals.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
If I may, I'd like to address very quickly Justice Baker's question about the relief requested and then Chief Justice Phillips' question about Article 3, Section 51A. Justice Baker, your question about the relief requested, in fact, demonstrates exactly why disparate impact alone cannot be sufficient to violate the ERA. Think about the relief that would have to be ordered in this case. The relief would be you tell the state you either have to pay for all medically necessary abortions or you have to stop paying for childbirth. But if the state chooses to stop paying for childbirth, there's still a disparate impact on women. In fact, the refusal to pay for medically necessary abortions or childbirth affects only women under their theory. And so you have to say, well, then you stop paying for medically necessary abortions or you stop paying for pregnancy expenses.
I think the relief requested was much broader. It went to the whole program as opposed to just childbirth.
And that's the point. At what point do you have to go up those levels of disparate treatment until you get to a point where there's not different treatment for men and women? You've got to go up beyond the abortion choice, beyond pregnancy.
I think Ms. Jones would say that you just provide all, if you're going to fund for medically necessary procedures, then you do it for all medically necessary procedures. Have I missed the point?
No, that's right. Okay. But the point is, so the only choice the state is left with is we don't have a Medicaid program or we pay for medically necessary abortions. Because you've got to get all the way up to the level of treatment of men and women to where there's no disparate impact before you can get to their theory you don't violate the ERA.
Let's ask, I want to talk about disparate impact. I'm curious about this. The Feeney case that dealt with veterans' benefits discriminated between men who are veterans and men who are not veterans, right? And it discriminated between women who were veterans and women who were not veterans. Right.
That's incorrect. On its face, it discriminated in the sense that it denied particular benefits to a particular class. It discriminated between people who are veterans and people who are not veterans.
Right. But the disparate impact argument was that because most veterans were men, it impacted women on a greater degree than it impacted negatively men. Right?
Not just on a greater degree. Or mostly, it was 98.3% men. Only 1.7% of the beneficiaries.
Well, since I was comparing men and women, I was using greater, but I could use greatest, but I think grammatically it wouldn't be correct. But at any rate, that's a disparate impact argument. That's what Ms. Jones is talking about. She says Feeney doesn't apply because this isn't a disparate impact. This is a place where when the law is applied, men are not affected at all. And only women are affected. So there's no negative impact as between men who need medically necessary treatment and get it, and men who need medically necessary treatment and don't get it. The only impact is on women who need medically necessary treatment, but as to a particular medically necessary treatment, they don't get it. How do you say that that's a disparate impact argument?
Number one, the record in this case, they did a fantastic job in the record in this case of demonstrating that this law effect has an impact on women. But they have not shown in the record that it does not have any impact on men. And as we pointed out in our brief, to the extent that any of the women that make this choice are married, the cost of paying for that abortion without state funding is borne by the husband under the community property laws. There are men affected by it, too. Their record doesn't support their own argument. But even if it did, even if it was only women 100%...
I don't understand. You mean they have to put on a disparate impact case? I mean, they've chosen not to challenge it under a disparate impact theory.
No, I'm saying that they're trying to distinguish Feeney, Justice Hankinson, by saying in Feeney there was 1.7% of the people impacted were women. Whereas in this case, none of the people impacted are men. And what I'm saying is they haven't demonstrated that in the record at all.
But I think their theory is that no man is denied medical treatment for a medically necessary condition.
It's not the denial of medical treatment. It's the denial of the funding for that medical treatment that the state law effectuates here.
Well, in an indigent population, in many instances, that's effectively denying them the treatment.
And so you've got to carry that analysis to some smaller segment of the population we're complaining about, to say some smaller segment of the population then doesn't get that particular treatment
at all.
Would you
respond to Ms. Jones's argument that McLean provides the roadmap for how this case should be decided?
It can't, because the law in McLean was facially discriminatory on the basis of gender. Because of gender, we're going to treat these men differently than these women.
Well, her response to that is that they've challenged the entire implementation package associated with the Medicaid program in Texas, and that when you look at that, it is facially discriminatory. What's your response to that?
Well, they need to point to the statute that they're complaining about, because in order to determine if there's facial discrimination, you got to look at the language of that particular statute. The statute is 32.024 of the Texas Human Resources Code, and the language says nothing about women, nothing about abortion.
Well, but she says that their challenge extends beyond just the statute to all the implementing regulations.
And the regulations cannot be the basis for the challenge, because all the regulations do is implement what the Hyde Amendment, the effect of the Hyde Amendment for purposes of implementing the program by the Department of Health. So the challenge has got to be to the statute. If I may briefly address Chief Justice Phillips' question about Article 51A.
I'm still interested.
I have looked at that and do recall the issue. The problem with that, I think, frankly, is, I mean, certainly what Article 351A does is it provides a constitutional basis for the policy choice made by the legislature.
But you essentially agree with Ms. Jones' analysis.
Well, not exactly. What I would say is that argument is susceptible to the counterargument, which says that one provision of the Constitution cannot be construed so as to violate another. To the extent that you find that a statute violates, for example, if you were to find disparate impact sufficient in and of itself, so that the statute violates the ERA, you could not then construe Article 351A to say, well, it doesn't matter if it violates the ERA because Article 351A says that's okay. You can't construe one provision to allow for a violation of another.
But does it provide a reason for a policy decision?
Well, it certainly...
Which the majority says the state never showed.
It certainly provides that the people of Texas, through their Constitution, have expressly blessed the policy choice made by the legislature in this case in 32024.
Without that provision of the Constitution, there couldn't be a Texas Medicaid program. Yes, right.
Yes, because of Article 351, I guess, that would prohibit the expenditure of funds to individuals.
But once you have this provision, it allows the Medicaid program, and then it says the Medicaid program has to be at least as enough to get federal funding, but it doesn't specifically prohibit a program more generous than the federal minimum, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Any other questions?
Mr. Boyd, Justice Baker's earlier question to you on standing. As I understood the answer from Ms. Jones, three males brought this suit alleging an Equal Rights Amendment violation on behalf of women. Did the state object to that class certification? Is that issue still preserved on appeal?
There is no class certification, I'm aware. The state asserted lack of standing as an affirmative defense in its original answer in the case. However, the state did not assert that as a ground in support of its summary judgment. Frankly, under the Roe decision, the state's position would be that Roe was wrong on that standing analysis. But under the Roe decision, the court recognized an interest not only of the pregnant woman, but also of her physician in light of the physician-patient relationship. I don't think this court has to get there because I think the state prevails.
But that distinction is not based on the financial interest of the physician urging the low-income women's physician.
That's correct. May I close
that? That seems to be their argument, or am I mistaken?
Well, again, I'm not sure that we ever fully argued or briefed the standing issue. We asserted it in our affirmative
defense.
Well,
are you now saying you don't think it exists in the case or that it's still there?
I think the state's position here is that these doctors, under a proper analysis of the physician-patient relationship, would not have an adequate interest to give them standing in this case. But I don't think this court has to get there in order to find for the state as it should.
Does anyone want to hear the closing?
May I just simply urge the court to
render. You're on our time, we have to.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first clause. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.